The acting and camouflaging of her symptoms was exhausting, and Angela wasn't sure how much longer she could keep up the ruse. But a reprieve was coming. Thomas was scheduled to inspect a worksite in Indianapolis over the weekend and meet with the builder, who was planning a 150-home subdivision. Thomas and Bill were bidding on the job, and he would be gone all of Saturday and most of Sunday. Talk of canceling the trip had started after Thomas came home a few days before to find Angela covered in blood and melting down in ways she had never before displayed to her husband. But desperately needing both time away from Thomas's suffocating concern and the opportunity to explore her suspicions about Leonard Williams, Angela had used all her willpower and doubled the usual dosage of Valium to put up a facade of normalness and well-being. Now, Saturday morning, Angela gave one more push while she and Thomas sat at the kitchen table and drank their morning coffee. "Just go," Angela said. "I'm feeling much better." Thomas looked at her.
"You're taking the medication, right?"
"I am. It's helping."
"I'm worried about being gone overnight. Bill should be able to handle this without me."
"I'll be fine," Angela said, trying to hide the urgency in her voice. "And we need this contract. It would make our year."
"We're doing fine," Thomas said. "It would be nice, but we don't need it."
"Go," she said, looking him in the eye the way she seldom did anyone else. "I'm okay." An hour after she watched Thomas back his truck out of the garage and drive down the alley on his way to Indiana, Angela pulled away from the curb and headed for the highway. Thomas and Bill had four warehouses spread between Kenosha, Wisconsin, the north and west sides of the city, and Hammond, Indiana. Leonard Williams ran the warehouse in Kenosha, so with Thomas gone, Angela was on her way to the Wisconsin location. Kenosha was about an hour and a half from the city, and Angela consulted her map after she turned off the highway. Eventually, she turned down the long road that led to her husband's Wisconsin office and construction warehouse. A trail of dust floated behind her vehicle as she drove. Situated at the end of a long industrial park, the office was one of many single-story buildings that lined the gravel road. When Angela pulled up to the office on Saturday morning, hers was the only vehicle present. She put the car into park, but left the engine running and the air conditioning raging as she listened to the radio. There had been a development overnight in the case of the Summers missing women, and WGN offered the latest details. "We can confirm," the reporter said through the radio, "that the body found early this morning is suspected to be that of Samantha Rogers, who had gone missing 3 weeks ago and was considered to be the thief's fifth and most recent victim." Sitting in her car, Angela's mind flashed to the night she and Catherine had watched the news report in her living room about the missing woman named Samantha Rogers. She had since created a biography on the woman, and Angela knew all the details about her disappearance. The date she went missing, the last place she was seen, the last time her parents and friends had spoken with her, and the exact location where the cab had dropped her the night she disappeared, Western and Kedzie, a mere block from her apartment. Angela knew the details about Samantha Rogers before the reporter spoke. In fact, she knew much more than the news story offered. Angela knew the girl so well that her heart ached at the idea that there was no hope she would be found alive. "We are still waiting for the Chicago Police Department to confirm the victim's identity, but it is widely believed that the body of Samantha Rogers has been found in a wooded area in Forest Glen, miles away from the victim's apartment in Wicker Park. We will stay on top of any new developments and interrupt regularly scheduled programming with any breaking news." As Angela shut off the car's engine, she realized her heart was drumming. When she pulled the keys from the ignition, they jingled with the tremor in her hand. She steadied herself as she climbed from the car and looked around. She knew the warehouse would be quiet at this time on a Saturday morning, The work crews were already out to job sites. She walked across the gravel lot. The office door was locked when she tried the handle. Before she left her house, Angela had retrieved a set of keys attached to a Chicago Bears keychain, which rested in the back of the kitchen drawer. Pulling the ring from her purse, she went one by one until she inserted the correct key into the door handle and twisted it open. She slipped into the office and closed the door behind her, looking back through the window and out into the parking lot. Her car sat all alone. The dust storm she had caused by driving down the industrial road had dissipated to a white cloud that hazed the area. Angela took a moment to look toward the far end of the road, which was empty and quiet. She locked the door and turned away from the window. She went past the desk in the front office and pulled open the drawers to the file cabinets that lined the back wall. It took 10 minutes of fingering through the files for Angela to find the employment records. Mitchell Blackwell Construction had 77 employees. It took only a minute to locate the file that held the name Leonard Williams. She pulled the file and sat on the floor to read it. The first page held a Xeroxed photo of Leonard Williams's driver's license. A feverish chill claimed Angela's shoulders as she stared at the dark-set eyes and expressionless face of the man who had approached her weeks ago in the alley behind her home. Angela learned that he was 52 years old, previously employed by another construction outfit in the western suburb of Wooddale, and had come to Mitchell Blackwell with glowing letters of recommendation from his previous employer. He was married, with 2 children. As she paged through the thin file, something pulled at her mind. It was the way her brain operated. There was something she had seen but not recognized, some bit of relevance that had buried itself in her subconscious, but which hadn't yet floated to the surface of her awareness. Angela had always been able to sense this acute mindfulness of something critical, even if she wasn't able to immediately identify it. She blinked away the glitch in her thoughts, ignored the soft whisper that echoed in the far-off parts of her mind, and continued to flip through the file. 1099 forms, employment contracts, workmen's compensation paperwork, and union credentials. Until it finally dawned on her. Until the whisper turned into a scream. She turned back to the opening page of the file and looked at Leonard Williams's driver's license again. Her vision narrowed to focus on his address. He lived in Forest Glen, the same neighborhood where Samantha Rogers's body had just been discovered. Chicago, August 1979. Angela jotted Leonard Williams's address onto a piece of scratch paper, replaced the file, and closed the cabinet. She walked around the secretary's desk and to the side door that led to the warehouse, pushed it open, and entered the cavernous space. The rafter ceilings were 3 stories high, and light penetrated the grimy windows in a cloudy gray film that left Angela squinting in the murkiness. She found the light switch and clicked the warehouse to life with fluorescent bulbs that blinked and warmed. Giant trucks occupied the space, and pallets of dry concrete lined the walls, packaged in green bags and stacked high. Other equipment she didn't recognize or understand hung from the walls and stood in tall piles in the middle of the warehouse. Angela walked around the equipment. This was the place Leonard Williams operated and supervised. In the back, she came to a filmy window that looked out onto the parking lot. She saw her car isolated in the gravel lot, and again looked to the end of the long road that led from the main thoroughfare to the warehouse. It was desolate, and the emptiness of the place suddenly brought Angela aching lungs and shallow breaths. She felt the twinge of an impending attack, and fought against the pull of her mind to go to that dark place and entertain disturbing thoughts of Leonard Williams from the morning in the alley, his shadow climbing over her legs as he came closer to her, his black eyes, and his body silhouetted by the steep angle of the sun. But she felt something else, too, something that made it easier than normal to get past the roadblocks in her mind. The same stutter in her thoughts from a few moments earlier, while she looked through Leonard Williams's file and unknowingly saw his address, was happening again now as she stared out the window. Something screamed for her attention. She was in the corner of the warehouse, with the back wall immediately to her left and the side wall with the grimy window in front of her. Something was off. As Angela looked again out at the parking lot, she remembered the image from when she had climbed from her car. She had parked at the edge of the warehouse, yet her car was many feet to the left of the window she was staring through. Angela looked at the back wall and realized the warehouse did not end where she stood, but continued beyond this point. Moving away from the window, she walked along the back wall. It was covered in wooden shelving that rose up a full story. Heavy equipment and pallets of material filled the shelves. A forklift was parked nearby to claim the items from the higher shelves. As Angela walked along the back wall, she noticed a break in the shelving, in front of which sat a pallet of concrete. Behind the pallet, a tarp hung like a curtain and partially covered a door. An eerie feeling came over her as she looked back through the warehouse toward the office. The rafters creaked with the wind. The roll of her stomach returned. She had swallowed 2 Valium on the way over and resisted the urge to fish another from the bottle. She turned back to the partially hidden door, squeezed her small frame past the stacked bags of concrete, and tried the handle. Locked. She opened her purse and pulled out the keys attached to the Chicago Bears ring. She stuck one after the other into the doorknob until, on her 5th try, the lock twisted open. Angela pushed the door, allowing it to swing on the hinges and glide into the darkened room until it struck the wall after a full 180-degree turn. She reached her arm in and felt for a light switch. The overhead lights brought the space to life, and she slowly walked into the large storage area. Rows of shelving lined the walls. Another wall was lined with barrel-sized oil cans. The floor was caked with mud, unlike the dusty concrete slab of the warehouse. On the floor next to the large oil cans was a dirty tarp, a shovel, rope, and a stack of cinder blocks. She lifted the top from one of the cans and peered inside. It was dark and empty. As Angela slowly turned in the storage room, her skin was itchy and flushed. She took deep breaths to settle her stomach, but still bile rose in her throat. In the darkened corner, she saw a strange contraption hanging from the tall ceiling. She walked closer to get a better look. Bolted to the ceiling was an M-shaped wooden beam. 5 pulleys were fastened at each point of the M, through which thick rope was strung. The rope hung down from each end of the beam like the loose limbs of a willow tree. 6 feet separated the 2 ends of the rope. Angela walked even closer. Attached to each end of the rope was a strap of red nylon tied in a noose. It reminded her of some contraption from medieval times. Angela held the nylon noose in her hand, pinching the soft red material between her thumb and forefinger, when she heard a thud outside. She released the noose, ran to the door of the storage room, and peeked out into the warehouse. It was still dingy and gray, and the large overhead doors were closed. She heard the pounding once again. Squeezing between the shelving and pallet of concrete that hid the storage room door, Angela ran back to the window and looked out at the parking lot. One of the concrete trucks had returned and was dumping waste into a reservoir across the parking lot. The truck was backed up against a retaining wall, with its tank at a 90-degree angle as workers barked orders to the driver. Angela ran the length of the warehouse and into the office. She locked the door on the way out and hurried to her car as the workers continued their dumping 50 yards away. She steadied herself by leaning on the hood and breathing in the humid summer air. When the nausea passed, Angela climbed into the driver's seat and reached for her purse. She pulled out her bottle of Valium, swallowed another pill, and tore out of the parking lot, accelerating down the industrial road and kicking up a cloud of dust in the process. The M-shaped contraption and dual nooses burned in her vision like the afterimage of a flashbulb, just like the reporter's image from the night she watched the news report about Samantha Rogers. And then something else, another whisper, far in the recesses of her mind, just a slight murmur, asking to be heard. She knew she should stop and listen to it, attempt to decipher what it was trying to tell her, but she was hardly aware of it as she sped along the gravel road, fighting to breathe and control her shaking hands, let alone able to comprehend its muddled message. Chapter 14. Chicago, October 24th, 2019. Rory had never appreciated post-coital affection and, in fact, needed her space after intimacy. Having slept together for 10 years, Lane no longer questioned Rory's stealthy escape from the bedroom after sex. During the early phase of their relationship, she used to wait until Lane was asleep before attempting her getaway, but now it was just expected. She was slow and quiet as she slipped from beneath the covers, pulling a tank top over her head and tiptoeing downstairs. In the kitchen, she opened the refrigerator, spilling soft light across the floor as she grabbed a Dark Lord. In her office, Rory sat at her desk and opened the file that waited there. With the rest of the house dark, her workspace was lit only by the soft auburn glow of the desk lamp. She took a sip of stout and began reading. The thief had hired the law firm of Garrison Ford immediately after his arrest. The 1979 retainer had been $25,000, which was paid with a cashier's check. The total fee for representation, which included the failed defense and the contentious trial, was close to $120,000, also paid via cashier's check in four lumps between the summer of 1979 and the winter of 1981. All of this information was contained in the third and final box Ron Davidson had delivered, along with the file from her father's office and the information Judge Boyle had provided. Rory took a sip of beer and turned the page. The best she could piece together, her father had become involved with the thief during the appeals process, after the 60-year sentence had been handed down. Garrison Ford continued to bill for services into 1982, when her father left the firm to start his own practice. Cross-referencing documents she unearthed from her father's file cabinets at his law office, Rory found a transition of invoicing that started in the latter half of 1982. The first check was written to the Moore Law Group on October 5, 1982, to finance the second round of appeals. Rory found that all reimbursements, old Xerox copies of handwritten checks, were full lump-sum payments. Over another beer, she learned that in addition to being a cold-blooded killer, her father's client was also a millionaire. At the time of his arrest, he had a net worth of $1.2 million. The man's financials were intimately detailed in his file because, in addition to handling appeals and representation at parole hearings, the man had also hired her father to look after his fortune during his incarceration, a task that included resolving debts, bringing his estate into order and liquidating assets. Dipping into the dark side of criminal defense, Rory saw how her father had structured this man's fortune in an oasis of LLC corporations and trusts to hide assets and protect against the threat of civil lawsuits. Sheltered as it was, had the families of his other alleged victims gone after him, a large portion of his money would be off limits. But no civil suits were ever filed. Without bodies, Rory knew, a civil suit would be deemed frivolous. The remains of only one woman were found during the summer of 1979. Her name was Samantha Rogers, and although there had been an attempt, Rory read, to tie the thief to this woman, the attorneys at Garrison Ford had managed to convince the judge that any evidence linking their client to Samantha Rogers was purely circumstantial. The judge agreed, and the prosecution dropped their pursuit, instead focusing on Angela Mitchell. Her father's client's money stayed protected, and all told, when the killer settled into his cell in the early 1980s, he did so with more than $900,000 resting in a bank account. Through the 1980s, Rory's father had drawn from those funds to pay his legal fees during the lengthy appeals process, which dragged on for a decade. In addition to checks rendered for legal services, Rory also came across additional payments categorized as retainer fees. Over the course of the 1980s, the Moore Law Group had been paid more than $200,000. It was a steep sum to simply file appeals. The roots of her curiosity stretched deeper into her mind, as she recognized that her father's connection to this man went beyond the typical attorney-client relationship. "What were you doing for this guy, Dad?" Rory read the details of the appeals her father had crafted, which highlighted the prosecution's weaknesses. They included, conveniently, that the district attorney could produce no physical evidence against his client, including the body of his alleged victim. Adding to the absence of Angela Mitchell's remains, Rory's father had argued that the woman was mentally retarded, as was stated in the 1979 brief. The term cognitively challenged was still decades away, and labeling her as autistic was less dramatic, too medical, and didn't fit the narrative. A mentally retarded schizophrenic was much more powerful. But no matter which adjectives had been used to describe Angela Mitchell, none were quite right. As Rory learned more about what the woman had done and the lives she had surely saved, nowhere in the documents was Angela Mitchell described as hero. According to the statement by the prosecutor, Angela had spent the last days of her life compiling evidence that pointed a strong finger at the 1979 killer. She was killed during the process. Chicago, August 1979. It was Sunday morning, less than 24 hours since her bizarre discovery in the warehouse, and Angela had not slept a minute. She was up all night updating the biographies of the missing women, and adding everything to her notes that she had found in the last 3 days about Leonard Williams. After leaving the warehouse yesterday, she had spent hours at the library, spinning microfilm and researching hanging and strangulation deaths associated with women in and around Chicago. Below the graph diagram Angela had put together depicting the trend of killings over the last decade, she now added relevant information from her library research. She was trying to make sense of the contraption she had found in the hidden storage room, and believed she was onto something. Of the women on her graph who fit the description, who fell into the profile, and who had been killed in and around Chicago, most had been strangled. On the last page of her file, Angela had drawn the odd M-shaped wooden beam with the dual hanging nooses. Ever since rushing from the warehouse to pour through microfilm at the library, the entire time she was creating her documents and graphs and working out her theory about Leonard Williams, all through the night and up until this morning when she arrived at Catherine's house, that soft whisper in her mind nagged and annoyed. Angela never stopped her work to listen, and feared the voice that was calling her was a side effect of the Valium, which she was swallowing at an alarming rate. Or it was the logical and reasonable part of her mind working to be heard, trying to tell her that she was over-medicating herself and that her ideas about the missing women were ridiculous. She sat at Catherine's kitchen table now, pushed the whisper of that voice away, and showed her work to her friend. Catherine sat patiently and listened to Angela tell the story of her trip to the warehouse, her discovery that Leonard Williams lived so close to where Samantha Rogers's body had been found, that of the women who had been killed and who matched the description of the missing women from this summer, all had been strangled. And finally, she showed Catherine the bizarre image she had drawn of the dual noose contraption. Catherine took a sip of coffee when Angela finally looked at her. "You know I always support you," Catherine said. But what? Angela asked. "I think everything that's going on this summer has set you off." What do you mean? I think you're very nervous about what's going on.
So am I.
But I think you feel like it's your responsibility to figure this out. And, Angela, some of what you're showing me is...
Is what?
It's hard to digest. All the research you've done on the missing women and how they might be connected to a decade-long string of murder.
I think they are.
But now you're telling me you think you know who did this, and that it's a man who works for Bill and Thomas.
Angela looked away from Catherine and back to her notes, her cheeks suddenly red and searing. She gathered the papers and stuffed them into the file folder. Her research and her theories, all contained in the file folder, sat on the kitchen table, like some foreign and unwanted artifact found in the wild. Neither knew quite what to do with it or how to handle it. If it were worth anything at all, or just a useless bit of something unearthed and dragged inside.
"I think Leonard Williams scared you in the alley," Catherine finally said, placing her hand on Angela's. "And I think that's made you look at him in a way that most wouldn't see him. From what I know, he's a family man. He's got a wife and kids, Angela. He's not some deranged serial killer. I don't think you've done anything foolish, let me be clear. But reasonably looking at all of this, I don't know that I totally agree with everything you're suggesting. Angela, I'm not sure I totally believe all of this."
Angela swallowed hard at the rejection. Her surroundings faded as memories of her childhood flooded her mind. Her teacher's disparaging comments anytime Angela made a remark in school. Her parents' constant refusal to listen to Angela's reasoning on any subject. Her psychiatrist's outright dismissal of her pleas for help when the lithium drew wild hallucinations in her vision. All the images from her childhood carried her away, and only when she heard talking did she come back to the present. When she did, she found Bill Blackwell standing next to Catherine. There was a far-off echo. Angela tried to hear it, but it was hollow and muted. She saw Bill's lips moving and realized the man was speaking to her. She blinked her eyes.
"The second time in a week that I come home to a surprise," she heard Bill say. "Is Thomas back from Indiana yet?"
Angela focused her eyes on the bandana around Catherine's husband's neck. She realized the soft, echoing voice she had heard a moment before was not that of Bill Blackwell, but instead the whispered voice she had been hearing since her visit to the Kenosha warehouse. It was finally loud enough to decipher. It was screaming, in fact, as she stared at the man in front of her. Angela's mind flashed to the night they all ate dinner in her home. She remembered Bill's red neck, explained then as an allergic reaction to insect repellent and the remnants of mosquito bites. She remembered his bandana from the last time she sat in this kitchen with Catherine. And now today, she looked at his bandana-covered neck to see deep red marks on his skin. Marks that could come from a noose. Angela stood quickly. The kitchen chair toppled backward and ricocheted off the kitchen floor. She backed away and, without saying a word, turned and hurried out the front door. Her thick file folder remained on the table.
Chapter 15. Chicago, October 25th, 2019. Rory made it through the screening process again and entered the judge's chambers after the security guard had escorted her through the hallways. Now she sat, just like she had at their original meeting, in front of the desk while the judge took to his throne behind it, the high-back leather chair rising well above his head as he sat.
"Lots to cover," Judge Boyle said. "Have you made yourself familiar with your client?"
Your client. The sound of it bothered Rory in many ways. She didn't have clients. Her life revolved around cases. Her life revolved around helping victims, not the men accused of killing them. An acidic burn rose up her esophagus and settled in the back of her throat, but Rory swallowed it down. Her interest in Angela Mitchell was stronger than her GERD, and her father's mysterious role in the thief's life had won a spot in her psyche. She knew she couldn't dump this case until she learned what exactly her father had been doing with this man for all these years.
"Yes, sir," Rory finally said.
"Excellent. Your father and I had worked out many of the stipulations relating to this man's release. Here are a few of them."
Judge Boyle handed a single piece of paper across his desk. On it was a long list of bullet points. He read from his own copy.
"There was a request to forego a halfway house as a living requirement. Considering your client's notoriety, his age, and his financial means, I've agreed to this request. He is required to stay in Illinois for 24 months, however. Your client owns a home in the state, out near Starved Rock State Park. It's about an hour outside of the city. Frank had requested that your client be allowed to keep this as his residence, and I've agreed. However, there is a list of stipulations that will need to be met. You and the social worker, as well as your client's assigned parole officer, will need to visit the property ahead of time and make certain it meets the requirements."
"What requirements, sir?"
Judge Boyle pushed another sheet of paper across his desk.
"It needs to have a landline for phone, as your client will be required to check in daily with his parole officer for the first 3 months. Internet access is not mandatory, but suggested. The property needs to have a USPS mailing address. POB addresses are not allowed. Photos of the home will also need to be taken and placed in the formal file. Your trip to the home should be scheduled this week. You'll coordinate it with Naomi Brown, the social worker?"
The judge posed the statement as a question, but Rory understood his tone to be less of a request than an order. She nodded.
"There is a substantial sum of money that your client will have access to upon his release. Your father had financial power of attorney for the last 4 decades. Now that Frank is gone, the money will be handled exclusively by your client. That's over $800,000, Counselor. He's never been in this new world of digital banking. He'll need some help getting settled. So, of course, release the funds to him, but I'll expect you to be his steward. For the first 18 months after his release, you'll be required to provide me with financial updates to prove that he will not squander his fortune or become," the judge paused, "a victim of financial predators looking to take advantage of him. The state of Illinois has spent enough money on this man. I'd like to make sure we spend no more after he is released."
Rory made notes.
"Finally," the judge said, "he is 68 years old. He obviously has the means not to work, and his notoriety prevents him from meaningful employment. It's best for now that your client disappear for a while. Maybe forever. The property near Starved Rock has been held in a trust, so his name is not attached to it. He will be difficult to track down after release. Of course, everyone in authority who needs to find him will have easy access. But the trolls will be looking for him, and it's up to you to help him stay anonymous. Your father had done a lot of work to this end."
The judge closed the file and stood, as if he had even more pressing issues to attend to.
"Is there anything else?"
"Yes," Rory said. She swallowed down the acid again. "I'll have to see him before the formal parole hearing to go over a few other things. To my knowledge, he doesn't even know his attorney has died." The circumstance of seeing a stranger in the close quarters of a visitation room, of having to look him in the eye and explain that she was his new attorney, was something Rory would have normally run from. Typically, she'd have done anything to avoid such a thing, arms up and slithering from its hold like a child escaping her mother's grip. But Rory was after something. She didn't give a shit about the man they called the thief. She wanted to know what her father was doing for him, because she knew damn well it wasn't simply tending to his legal needs.
That can be arranged,
Judge Boyle said.
I'll put in the request so that it's expedited.
Chicago, August 1979. Angela's birthday fell on Tuesday, 2 days after Catherine had rejected her, the way everyone from Angela's adolescence had done. 2 days after, she saw Bill Blackwell's neck and the ugly red gouges he hid with a bandana. 2 days since Angela had put all the haunting pieces to this summer together. 2 full days and she had done nothing. It had been 2 days of very little sleep, her mind allowing only thoughts about the missing women, and questioning her belief that Bill Blackwell was part of it all. That the peculiar practice of dual hanging was the method he had used to kill the women. 2 days of questioning her theory that the disappearances were part of a much broader string of homicides, which dated back an entire decade. 2 days of panic and doubt. And if Angela doubted herself, she couldn't blame Catherine for rebuking her.
Is the wine okay?
Thomas asked, bringing Angela back from her thoughts. Knowing she didn't like crowds, Thomas made early dinner reservations. Now, on her birthday, they sat at a candlelit table sipping red wine, while the restaurant was only sparsely occupied. Angela did her best with the acidic Cabernet that was upsetting her frail stomach. She smiled. It's good. She had been close to confessing everything to Thomas when he arrived home on Sunday night. But instead, she kept things bottled up, allowing her mind to run wild. She had, Angela knew, lost all control of her thoughts. Not even the Valium was able to corral her psyche. The lack of sleep had her ragged and on edge. She wrestled with her uneasy stomach through dinner and then declined dessert.
You don't want dessert on your birthday?
Thomas asked. I'm not in the mood for sweets. But you go ahead.
No, we'll skip it tonight. I have something for you,
Thomas said, producing a small wrapped present from the breast pocket of his jacket. Everything that had transpired since that day in the garage when Angela had attempted to move the old couch out to the alley for trash pickup, her encounter with Leonard Williams, her overwhelming bout of obsessive compulsion that had stolen an entire week, the forming of her theory about the missing women dating back for a decade, the report of Samantha Rogers's body being found, and most recently, her bizarre discovery in the warehouse, her research about the disturbing practice of dual asphyxiation, and thoughts of Bill Blackwell being involved in all of it, had caused Angela to forget about the necklace she found in the old picnic basket. The events of the past week had nearly caused her to forget her birthday altogether. Now, as she sat with the gift in front of her, she was grateful for having forgotten about the necklace. Had it been present in her mind, she wouldn't have been able to play off being surprised. Can I open it? She asked.
Of course, Thomas said.
Angela pulled the wrapped box in front of her. She carefully tore away the paper and opened the top of the small box. She squinted her eyes at the diamond earrings that rested on the felt interior, with no attempt to hide her confusion.
You don't like them?
Thomas asked. She looked up at her husband, who was staring with a confused look on his face that matched Angela's. No, no, she quickly said. I love them, I just... She shook her head. They're beautiful.
We can exchange them if they're not what you like. You pointed them out a few months ago when we were shopping. I thought they'd make the perfect surprise.
Angela nodded. They do. They're perfect. As she slipped the diamonds through the piercings in her earlobes, her mind could think of nothing but the necklace she had found hidden at the bottom of the picnic basket in her garage. Angela lay in bed, pretending to enjoy her husband's attention. Although their sex life had never been passionate, she and Thomas shared chemistry in the bedroom, and their lovemaking had always been enjoyable. But tonight, her mind was elsewhere. When he rolled off her, she lay with her head on his shoulder until she was certain he was sleeping. Then, to the sounds of his rhythmic breathing, Angela slipped out of bed. She pulled on her robe and sunk her feet into stockings. It was just past 11, a time of night she would never typically consider venturing outside. The thought of making the journey to the garage in the dead of night had her fingertips tingling and the scabs on her shoulders begging to be ruptured. But another urge overshadowed her fear and trumped even the strongest pull from the self-destructive parts of her mind. Curiosity. She knew sleep would never come, even with the liberal use of Valium, until she understood the mystery of the necklace. Angela avoided the light switches until she made it to the kitchen, where she turned on the dim light over the stove. She felt the flush in her cheeks and the familiar queasiness in her stomach as she looked through the kitchen window to the garage. Her pounding pulse and the audible rush of blood through the vessels of her head were her body's way of begging Angela to wait until morning, but she could not. Unlatching the back door, she stepped out into the night. The sweltering summer heat relinquished none of its power even this late, and Angela felt the humid air dampen her face. The neighborhood was quiet. She kept the patio light extinguished and carried a small flashlight with her. An impending panic attack made her breathing shallow. She hurried to the utility door at the back of the garage and ducked inside, bringing the interior to life with her flashlight. The dirty couch was still against the wall. She turned her attention to the cluttered shelves and found the picnic basket. Pulling it from its spot, she opened the top and shined her light inside. The thin necklace box remained just where she had left it. Angela reached into the basket and pulled it out. Opening the box, she found the necklace as it reflected the flashlight's brightness. In the darkened garage, she reached up to pinch the dangling earrings that hung from her lobes. She swallowed a sudden bolus of saliva that had formed in the back of her throat as she contemplated what it could mean. Thomas had been working late this summer, at least 2 or 3 nights a week. She remembered a string of phone calls last month when no one spoke after Angela had answered. A few times the caller had hung up just after Angela had uttered the word hello. She knew he'd hired a new secretary that summer. Now, as Angela stood in the darkened garage, she fought against the screams of her mind that told her Thomas was having an affair. The nausea returned and her stomach rolled. She retched once, then quickly dropped the necklace back into the basket and replaced it on the shelf. She raced through the utility door and vomited onto a small patch of grass in the backyard. Breathing heavily, she gulped the sticky summer air until a second wave of nausea passed. Then she hustled back into the house. She closed and locked the kitchen door just as the lights flashed on. When Angela turned around, Thomas stood in the kitchen, wearing only his boxer shorts. "What's going on?" he asked. Angela patted her nightgown, a nervous reaction to hide her confusion. It did just the opposite. "I thought I heard the trash cans rattling again. The top had fallen off," she said, immediately judging her lie to be somewhere between awful and completely unbelievable.
"Why didn't you wake me?"
he asked. "I just didn't want the neighbors to hear it. Mr. Peterson has been edgy since I blocked the driveway with the couch." Thomas walked to the back door and pulled the curtains to the side.
"The utility door to the garage is open," he said, looking at her.
"Is it? I hadn't noticed." Angela felt her stomach roiling again. Thomas unlocked the kitchen door and walked out to the garage. The sticky night air drifted into the house as Angela watched him enter the garage and turn on the lights. He disappeared out of sight for a full minute, during which the knot in her stomach tightened and pulled her to the washroom. She vomited again before steadying herself against the wall and resting her forehead on the back of her hand. She heard the floorboard squeak and, through watery eyes, saw Thomas standing in the bathroom doorway.
"Are you all right?"
he asked. "Not feeling well again."
"This is why you should have woken me," he said,
taking her under the arm and leading her back upstairs. She allowed him to guide her into bed.
"I saw that you vomited outside," he said, as he pulled the covers over her. "I'm calling the doctor in the morning. I know you've been resisting, Angela, but it's time to see the psychiatrist. Someone has to help you through this, and I don't know what else to do for you."
Angela had nearly run through her Valium. She'd need more, so she didn't protest. As Thomas climbed into bed next to her, Angela closed her eyes, but never slept. Chapter 16, Chicago, October 25th, 2019. The fracture had come together nicely, but it had taken a larger amount of epoxy than she preferred using. The additional adhesive was needed to ensure the eye socket of Camille Bird's childhood doll remained intact. Rory was unable to get herself into the correct mindset to reconstruct the woman's murder, so she concentrated on Camille Bird's doll instead. Once Rory immersed herself in the restoration, she found the doll's eye was the most challenging to repair. She had rebuilt the eye socket with a papier-mâché and plaster combination, a technique Zabina Escha had written about. Now that the epoxy and plaster had set and the eye was seated in the orbit, Rory was pleased with the result. When the doll was laid down, there was just a slight delay in the closure of the eyelid, which only the most astute observer would notice. She sanded the adhesive so that the seam of the original fracture was smooth. When Rory closed her eyes and ran her fingers over the doll's cheek, the fracture was undetectable. The feel of the doll's face had been perfectly restored. The appearance of Camille Bird's childhood doll, however, still left much to be desired. The additional epoxy and heavy polishing had left a badly discolored patch that ran, like a stream on a map, from the hairline down to the edge of the jaw. The curved ribbon of tarnished porcelain looked like a poorly healed scar. Rory knew the skills she had utilized to repair the fracture and reconstruct the eye socket were unmatched. She also knew where her weakness lay, and that was in bringing porcelain back to its original state. For this task, she would go to a master, to the one person who was better than she was. It was approaching midnight when Rory walked into the nursing home. She had gained permission from the staff and had been granted the access code to the front entrance to visit so late at night. The nurses knew Greta rarely slept at night, and that Rory's best chance for a coherent conversation usually came after midnight. Her last two visits with Aunt Greta had been failures. Since the passing of her father, Rory had trouble connecting with her great-aunt. With no children of her own, Aunt Greta's family consisted of her nephew, Frank Moore, and his daughter. Rory's father had been more like a grandson to Greta, and Rory like a great-grandchild. Over the course of her life, Rory had learned many things from Greta, including her love for restoring china dolls. It had once been their most cherished activity, restoring old dolls that had lined the walls of Greta's house. Their mutual love of antique doll restoration was the foundation of their relationship, and was how the two had become so close through Rory's childhood. Now, since dementia had stolen Greta's mind, the old dolls Rory brought to her bedside provided a different conduit to the past. They provided access to a part of Greta's history that was filled with joy, rather than the agonizing moments of Greta's life that the dementia usually dredged up. Tonight's visit also carried selfish undertones. Since she had requested a meeting with the thief, a tremor had taken hold of Rory's hands, the way they used to tremble as a child. Anxiety had plagued her since a young age, and the only way Rory managed her childhood was through the calming nature of Aunt Greta and the dolls they restored together. Rory's parents had known the effect Greta had on their child, and had shuttled Rory away when signs of her disorder became apparent. After a long weekend, or sometimes an extended stay that lasted a week or more, Rory would return to her parents' house restored and renewed, much like the dolls she and Greta worked on. Tonight, Rory needed the same healing powers Greta had delivered to her when she was a lost child. Rory carried Camille Bird's Kestner doll into the darkened room. Aunt Greta sat upright in bed with her eyes open, staring at nothing. Rory visited during the night not only because it was the most likely time to catch Greta in a coherent state, but also because Rory knew that sleep rarely came to her great-aunt during the small hours of night. The thought of Aunt Greta lying awake, staring into space, was never a comforting one. The woman had given Rory so much in life that Rory refused to allow her to spend the last stretch of her life alone. "Hey, old lady," Rory said when she approached the bedside. Greta's eyes flicked to the side, catching a glimpse of Rory for just an instant.
"I tried to save you. There was too much blood."
"I know," Rory said. "You did the best you could. And you helped many, many patients during your career."
"There's too much blood. We have to go to the hospital."
"Aunt Greta, everything is okay now. Everyone is safe."
"We have to go. I need help. There's too much blood."
Rory paused a moment as she stared at her. Finally, she took her hand and squeezed gently. "You promised you'd help me with a restoration. Do you remember?" Rory placed the box containing the Kestner doll on the bed. She immediately saw her aunt's demeanor change. Greta looked down at the doll, whose damaged face was visible through the window in the lid. "I had to use a lot of epoxy to fix the fracture, which required a great deal of sanding to smooth. I have it repaired perfectly, but need some help getting the porcelain back to its original color." Greta sat more upright in bed as Rory opened the box, removed the doll, and placed it on her aunt's lap. Rory found the controls and lifted the back of the bed upward so that Greta was fully erect. "I brought your pastels," Rory said, removing from her backpack a large assortment of fingernail polish-sized glass bottles filled with different colors. She wheeled the bedside table over and set the paints on the surface.
"I need better light," Greta said. Her voice was scratchy and hoarse, different now than the high-pitched ramblings when she was trapped in the throes of dementia.
Rory pulled over the lamp, clicked on the overhead lights, and watched her go to work. She was immediately transported to her childhood, to Greta's home, to the room lined with dolls and the workstation where she and Greta had spent hours and hours. "Hey," Rory said, while Greta painted a foundation coating over the repaired fracture. She kept her eyes on the Kestner doll as she spoke. "I've got to do something that's got me scared." Rory never used the words nervous or anxious. To do so would be to admit too much. Greta kept working, not even a glance in Rory's direction. She was lost in the restoration. "I've got to meet with someone Dad used to work with. A client." Rory waited a moment for any indication that Greta had heard her. "He's a bad man. An evil man, from what I know, but I have no choice but to meet with him." Greta finally stopped stroking her brush over the doll's face to look at Rory.
"You always have a choice."
Rory paused a moment.
"I guess that's true."
Greta went back to the doll, all her concentration channeled on coloring the repaired fracture streaming down from the eye socket. Of course, Greta's words were accurate. Rory could have simply told the judge that she would not take the case. Was she legally obligated to do so? It was a gray area. Being a partner in her father's law firm put Rory next in line to take his cases, but had she simply refused to do so, there was little Judge Boyle could have done. The truth was that Rory had already made the choice. She was meeting with this man for a reason. She had chosen to visit him face to face because there was something her father had been hiding. Rory wanted to know what it was, and the only person who could tell her was the man sitting in jail waiting on his parole. Greta spoke again as she attended to the doll,
her brush strokes even and purposeful as the fissure began to disappear.
Nothing can scare you unless you allow it to scare you.
Rory smiled and sat back in her chair. She loved the rare moments when she was able to connect with Greta, whose mind lately had seemingly been ravaged and stolen. 2 hours later, the first coat was finished and drying. To a casual observer, Camille Bird's doll looked perfect. But Rory knew it would take 2 more coats of paint and polish before it was truly flawless. For this, she was grateful. It meant she would soon have an opportunity to reconnect with her great aunt again. Chicago, August 1979. The day after her birthday was spent under Thomas's watchful eye. Angela did her best to keep things together as she acclimated herself to the idea of seeing a psychiatrist. There was no way to avoid it, and she knew Thomas would press the issue. Wild bouts of memories came back to her as she remembered her teen years spent under the authoritarian rule of her doctor, in whom her parents had placed their trust that he would control her wild outbursts, her self-inflicted wounds, and morph their introverted child into a normal, outgoing teenager. Angela had swallowed the last of her Valium after her venture to the garage the night before, and when the sun brightened the frames of the bedroom windows this morning, she was eager for the world to pull her from another night of torment. Alone in bed now, once the 9 o'clock hour came, she heard Thomas making phone calls. One of his calls was to Dr. Solomon, Angela knew, asking for a referral to a shrink. Angela had never mentioned to Thomas that Dr. Solomon's original recommendation had found its way into the trash, or that the doctor's last few phone calls had gone unreturned. Angela finally climbed from bed as Thomas continued to talk on the phone, his deep voice rumbling from the kitchen. She showered and dressed. When she walked downstairs, Thomas was drinking coffee at the kitchen table and analyzing a spreadsheet for work.
"I made coffee," he said. "Are you feeling better?"
"A little, yes," Angela lied as she poured a cup and sat across from him.
"I called the doctor," Thomas said. "He's out of the office until tomorrow. I left a message. I think I should go with you when you see the psychiatrist."
Angela didn't protest, just nodded.
"And I've got a problem with the job in Indiana. They need me to come down and have a look. At this time of morning, I'll miss rush hour. We'll get down there by early afternoon. Then I'll get back by tonight. Shouldn't be later than 8.
Angela felt for the first time that she might have overdone it with the Valium. A wave of indifference had come over her since she swallowed the last of the pills after her trip to the garage the previous night. The necklace hidden in the picnic basket and thoughts of Thomas's infidelity ricocheted through her mind. She thought of his late nights at the office, and his spree of out-of-town jobs that had him frequently spending nights away from home. Add that to Catherine's dismissal of her findings, and Angela felt alone and isolated, with no one to turn to. That wasn't true, she reminded herself. Through the fog of hazy thoughts, she knew she'd always have one person in her life she could trust. And the offer to help Angela, at any time, for any reason, had been unconditional. Angela had never thought she would need that help. Not since she had been saved when she was 18 had she needed help. Since then, she had been on her own, free from the confines of her parents and the shrinks and the psychiatric facility where they held her prisoner. But this morning, for the first time in years, Angela needed help. After all these years, she wondered if the offer still stood.
"Will you be okay by yourself?" Thomas asked. "I can call Catherine to see if she could stay with you today."
"No," Angela said. Her mind wandered back to her childhood when her parents watched her like hawks, always fearing the worst if they left Angela alone. And Catherine was no longer someone she could confide in. "I'll be fine." Thomas nodded, taking a long look at his wife.
"The girl at Dr. Solomon's office said he sometimes returns calls from home, so if the phone rings, make sure to answer it.
She said he's been trying to reach you, that he's called a couple of times.
Angela stared at her coffee. She felt the walls of her world constricting on her. She had erased Dr. Solomon's messages from the answering machine with the illogical thinking that if she erased the messages, she'd never have to talk with him. With the nonsensical reasoning that deleting Dr. Solomon's voice and his request for a return call would prevent her from having to return to the world of psychiatrists. Finally, Angela looked up at her husband and shrugged.
He hasn't called, that I know of, but I'll make sure to answer if the phone rings.
30 minutes later, she watched as Thomas backed out of the garage and into the alley. He pulled slowly away, headed back to Indiana for the day. The rumble of the truck's engine was barely out of earshot by the time Angela was on the move. She had been unable to follow the news for the past couple of days, knowing that Thomas would not like the idea of stirring her paranoia with news articles about the girl whose body had been found the week before. Now, with Thomas gone, Angela felt a